Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. Hello, I'm Peter Moore. Let's begin this episode by travelling back to the start of June 1944. Here is General Dwight D. Eisenhower addressing the Allied troops on the eve of D-Day.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, towards which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers-in-arms and other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of the Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe.
Welcome to a special D-Day anniversary episode of Travels Through Time. It's 75 years since the 6th of June 1944, when 150,000 Allied troops were landed on the beaches of Normandy in France in a single day. The beginning of Operation Overlord, or D-Day as it's commonly known, was also the beginning of the end of the Nazi war machine in Europe. It's also commonly remembered as the most famous military operation of the Second World War. I'm going to be exploring this history with an expert guest, as ever, in 3 pivotal scenes. Today's guest is the lecturer and military historian, Dr. Peter Caddick Adams. Peter has taught at Cranfield University and at the UK Defence Academy for much of the past 2 decades. And through his lecturing and writing, he's established a reputation as being one of the foremost military historians of his generation. His published works include a study of the 5-month Monte Cassino campaign in 1944 and a joint biography of Bernard Montgomery and Erwin Rommel. Peter's latest book, Sand and Steel, A New History of D-Day, documents the history of the plans and execution of Operation Overlord in forensic detail. James Holland, the writer, has called Sand and Steel a superb and timely book that will change our overview of D-Day forever. I met Peter at his publisher's in London the other day to talk about one of the most famous dates in all 20th century history. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Peter.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Good. And my first question to you is, what draws you to the history of the Second World War? Has it always been an interest for you?
My mother took me to see the movie Battle of Britain when it came out, and I was 10 years old, and that hooked me forever. But she was very clever because she'd been 10 years old when the real battle had been fought. So she wanted to introduce me to the sort of terror and context of her upbringing. Little did she know that that took me into making plastic model kits and then reading and studying both world wars. And of course, at that time, every adult had done something interesting in the Second World War, so that hooked me. It was talking to the veterans wherever they'd fought.
Mm. And the Second World War, I suppose, this period of 20th century history is very well written about. It's very well researched. How much new is there to say about it?
That's a very good question, and you might think that it's all done and dusted, but even from the Napoleonic era 200 years ago, we are discovering papers, letters, diaries in trunks, in attics. There's always something new to discover. And I think one of the interesting things is that we now have the advent of forensic archaeology. So archaeology never lies, and with modern techniques, we can piece together the past of either World War and much, much further back in a way that was impossible even 10 years ago.
I know at the start of your book, you write about your childhood visits to the Normandy beaches, and you talk about some of the defences that are still there, and you were managing to gather together bits of ammunition that was still lying around on the floor. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. 1975, my parents let me travel over to Normandy with some friends, and we were on the invasion beaches, and we met a chap in a kilt with a pair of bagpipes, and this turned out to be Piper Bill Millin, who was then the age I am now, so in his 50s, playing his bagpipes up and down the beach that he had landed on in 1944, and that completely mesmerised me. And he took us along the beach, pointed out the German bunkers, which were still there, and I remember that I think the following year, whilst our family sat and sunbathed on the beach, I dug the bunkers, and there in the sand were bullets and shell cases from the Second World War, and you can imagine the effect on a 14, 15-year-old.
Yeah, it's a strange confluence, isn't it, between the idea of leisure, the idea of, I don't know, relaxing on the beach, but then having all this history so close by, so the two of them coming together. I suppose we might often go on holiday to read a history book, but then in your childhood you had history just behind you waiting.
I think there's something deep within you, if you're a historian by vocation, that you want to reach out and touch the past. And whether you're going to the American Civil War and walking down a trench, or at Waterloo and you reach out and touch the walls of Hougoumont Farmhouse, on Normandy, there's so much more. There's all that concrete architecture from the Atlantic Wall, there's the sand dunes, the barbed wire in many cases, just as with the trenches of the First World War. And I think that's what brings history alive. You can see it, and you can take yourself back mentally to be a figure in the dramas of the past.
Well, that's a perfect way of setting us up for our travels, because this is exactly what we're going to be doing. We're going to go back to this time, 1944, and examine an enormous story through three little scenes, which might be a way of bringing the history back to life, I hope, for this podcast at least. So the first scene that you've chosen is Operation Fabius, or Fabius, is it?
Fabius, after a Roman emperor.
Okay, well, best get that right then. And this is on the 3rd and 4th of May, 1944. Do you want to tell us what this operation was and what was happening and where we are?
Well, the Allies have assembled millions of troops. There's 2.5 million Canadians, Brits and Americans in southern England waiting to leap and spring across the Channel. They don't know when or exactly where they're going to go, just their commanders, but they need to be exercised en masse in the final technique of an assault landing against France. So each division, all the supporting ships, the artillery, the engineers, the medics, everyone involved is going to be inserted into a last mass exercise to practice them in everything they've learned over the preceding year. And what we have to remember is the Allied soldiers who are going to arrive in France, average age 21, most of them have been rehearsing for at least the previous year. The Germans are mostly in their late 20s, 30s, sometimes 40s, so they're much older, less fit, and they just don't have that operational training or experience or understanding of firing live weapons in many cases. Some of them are recruits of only 4 weeks training. So we go back to the Allied soldiers. They need a huge exercise which will just take them and through their paces and confirm everything they've been doing. And this is Exercise Fabius. It's launched simultaneously for 4 of the 5 assault beaches. So the troops who land on Sword, Juno, Gold and Omaha are going to be exercised all the way along the south coast from Dorset, Hampshire, right through to East and West Sussex. And it happens simultaneously, so we can say it's the largest amphibious exercise ever launched in history. It's over 100,000 men, all the landing craft, aircraft, you name it. And in fact, just like D-Day, the weather is so appalling it's postponed for 24 hours. That's just fortuitous. And that's what Exercise Fabius is. So there's a build-up period, everyone's concentrated, they get on their ships, they then assault and they invade inland and mop up. So the amphibious phase of that is 2 days, 48 hours, 3rd and 4th of May. There's a few days before and a few days after. And the moment that ends, the troops go into lockdown to prepare for D-Day. So if you like, it's phase one of D-Day itself.
All right. So, and the thing that's just so striking when you're talking about this is the sheer number of people. Because we've had lots of scenes in this podcast, but probably none which encompasses such a panoramic landscape as the South Coast. Pretty much, I suppose, half of it at least. And it was such a large amount of people. I think you talk about the numbers in detail at the beginning of the book, and this is an amount of people about 3 million, which swells the British population from 47 to 50 million. Is that right? In total?
Yeah, I mean, the number of Americans, Canadians, Free French and Poles arriving during the Second World War is well in excess of 3 million. If you take a lot of the Brits away who are serving overseas, it means that out of every 10 adult males of fighting age between 18 and 40 in the UK at that time, population then 40 million, 4 are going to be from overseas and principally American. So the effect on the United Kingdom is just mind-blowing, and it's something we forget. 3 million American visitors passed through during World War II, mostly in 1943, 1944, and the effect on the home population is enormous, never mind the Canadians as well, and all the other varieties of soldiers from Europe who've escaped and are going to return. And I tripped over so many memories of families who'd adopted an American or a Pole or a Canadian, stayed in touch with them. Sometimes they didn't come back. A lot survived the war and stayed in touch with their families for decades afterwards. And it just showed you how close that bond was during war.
So there was a level of integration within British society with the GIs and the other soldiers. But what about on this particular day? Were they all on very different beaches? So the Canadians here, the British here doing their practice?
So that's exactly right. So the Americans are concentrating in sort of Weymouth, in the Weymouth sort of Dorset area. The Brits assaulting Gold Beach are in the Isle of Wight, Hampshire area, and the Canadians attacking Juno Beach are very near there. And then further along in sort of Worthing and Littlehampton, you've got the British assault forces who are going to go over to Sword Beach. So they're pretty much opposite the beaches that they will have been attacking. Okay. And that's why Fabius is so fascinating, because it's such a huge undertaking, and yet it's completely faded from public consciousness. And there's a very good reason for that, and that is the fifth beach, Utah. They had their exercise the month before, and this was Exercise Tiger, and that had gone wrong. The Germans had bumped into it in the middle of the night, had torpedoed some of the ships. They didn't know their good fortune in terms of disrupting this, and the Americans had lost nearly 1,000 casualties. So when we look back, all the drama about the rehearsals and the build-up to D-Day, everyone's attention is focused on Exercise Tiger. These other exercises, you know, nothing like those casualties, yet the scale is much, much larger. They're just as important, if not more so, but we've completely allowed them to fade from history. And that's what I'm doing. I'm the collector of stories. I'm handing on these tales and reviving aspects of D-Day that have been lost.
And of course, it's an operation which is inherently very dangerous, not just because you've got so many people. There's probably new technologies and equipment being tried out for the first time. Just to manage that number of people is difficult. But we know Winston Churchill's been talking in the House of Commons last year, saying what we and our American allies judge to be the right time, this front will be thrown open and the mass invasion of the continent will be begun in the West. So there's obviously a general understanding that an invasion is imminent. Is it like an open secret, or is there still a measure of subterfuge which is going on?
It's a very open secret. Even the Germans know that something is about to happen. Their defences have been built up, but they're being bombed every night. All the Atlantic Wall concrete bunkers are being attacked. All the rail lines leading into France, the roads, the bridges, even canals, are being hit by the RAF heavy and medium bombers, along with the Americans, who've largely been switched from a lot of their targets they're attacking in Germany. So the Germans understand that France is going to be attacked, they just don't know where or when. And it's exactly the same for the Allied soldiers. I mean, they're taking bets on what day or what part of France. And in late April, Eisenhower says to Churchill, "We've got to be so careful with secrecy. What I want is a lockdown of the south coast." And Churchill grumbles that this is contrary to democracy. And Eisenhower insists, and the other chiefs of staff, British, support him. So if you live on the south coast, within 10 miles indeed of the coast, so you know, millions of people probably are affected. You're not allowed in or out of that zone. If you live there, you can't leave it. If you're from outside, you can't enter it. All mail is stopped from the Royal Mail to be distributed around the country for 2 weeks. Diplomatic bags are suspended. A lot of people don't even know that this is happening, just to stop any leak that would give the Germans a clue.
So a sense of bewilderment, along with probably a mounting excitement that there's going to be a progression in the war.
Undoubtedly. I mean, everybody realises this. So if you read the New Yorker magazine, their correspondent in England writes that England right now resembles a giant warehouse full of equipment labelled Europe.
Okay.
And she's allowed to write that because it's so obvious, it's in general terms. But of course, it's a morale raiser.
Yeah.
And everyone in America has huge expectations. Everyone in England knows what's going on. The Germans are sort of, in some cases, their morale is quite high because they have their best general, Rommel, waiting.
Mm.
But the whole world is bubbling with excitement. I can't really put it better than that. But
yeah.
There's this huge electricity in the air that something is about to happen.
And just a supplementary question, really, because we know a lot about the Enigma machine and the interception of German messages through the top lines of their military. This has been happening at Bletchley Park for a long time. Is there something similar happening the other way round, or not really?
No, exactly. And again, this has largely been wiped from history. We focus on Bletchley, partly because the secrets of Bletchley were denied to us for three decades. The secret was only let out in 1974, before then, because we were going to use the same techniques against the Russians, or were. It was all kept extremely under wraps. So the Germans have all sorts of code-breaking organisations. So they're not exploiting one top-secret code, because we use several, and we're more multinational. But they do break some of the infantry exercise codes. They break the small ships codes used by the Royal Navy. They're reading the codes used by British Railways, moving troops and supplies around. So they know there's a movement down to the south coast of landing craft, of Royal Naval vessels, of trains, of men and equipment. They're aware of movements of aircraft across the Atlantic, the build-up of glider troops and parachute troops in southern England. So all the clues are there, but we are clever enough and tight enough in terms of security not to give them any pointers as to exactly where or when, but they start to make educated guesses.
And obviously the invasion is going to be in the Pas-de-Calais, no? That's where the British are heading, because it's the place with the harbours, that's the place where what is the shortest crossing of the channel. This is probably the, shall we say, the message they're trying to get out. Is it a bluff?
The easiest way to put it is, if you stand on the cliffs at Dover, you can see France, or vice versa, and that's what we have to remember. And that's why it's never going to work for the Allies, because the Germans could see what was happening. And if we launched an attack there, they would know straight away. So that's the ruse. However, we're in danger of overplaying that as historians. The Germans had built up all their defences around there, and they're now beginning to think elsewhere.
Well, let's leave it there, because I think this is the perfect point to go on to your second scene, which is on the 15th May. So this is a couple of, well, fortnight afterwards, after the great exercises on the south coast. And this is the Thunderclap Conference. Can you explain what this is and where this took place?
So there are actually two Thunderclap conferences. One is held at the end of April, but the 15th of May one is the crucially important one, and this is where all the top leaders assemble. And by that I mean the entire sort of upper echelons of government, from the United Kingdom, from the Dominions, South Africa, Canada, everyone resident in London. You've then got all the military commanders who take place and are commanding Operation Overlord from Eisenhower down, and they all assemble in one room, which is Montgomery's headquarters. Now, funnily enough, that's at his old school in St. Paul's.
Ah, okay. So
West London.
That's near Brook Green, is it not?
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
So. And he'd been a boy there, you know, 50 years earlier, more than that. And not surprisingly, he then commandeers the headmaster's study as his own office. But this is his event, and this is where he sells Operation Overlord to everybody else. And we've got to remember that, you know, in the context, the last amphibious operation was at Anzio in January 1944. Doesn't go very well. We've got Salerno and Sicily. The Germans mounted very severe counterattacks and they nearly failed. We've had things like Dieppe. Churchill's own experience was of writing the papers and strategy for Gallipoli. So amongst the whole senior echelons of the Allied commanders, there's great nervousness that D-Day could go wrong. And of course, it's a one-shot weapon. If for any reason it fails, then Churchill's credibility is on the line. Certainly our A-team of people like Eisenhower and Montgomery, could their reputation survive? The Allies couldn't do Normandy again if we got it wrong because of all the investment in deception. So it has to work, and I think the troops at the tactical level, the lower commanders, even the generals, divisional commanders, are confident. But at the upper level, there must have been huge nervousness. And this is where Montgomery presides. So Thunderclap is his conference. And if there's any doubts that people have before they walk into that conference, when they come out, it's Montgomery who's really sold the idea, and they all walk out bubbling full of confidence. And that's Montgomery's.
And you've written about Montgomery before, haven't you? So you know him well. What kind of a character was he? I noticed something that amused me when I was reading your book. You said he had a spaniel called Rommel, and he had a foxhound or something that answered to the name of Hitler. Is this right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that very senior commanders are so focused on the professionalism of their job, it makes them quite antisocial. They become almost monk-like figures. They're above and beyond and away from the normal banter. He didn't really follow art or culture or anything else. But it makes you so remote. What you want is company, and actually animal company is safe, because they can't take and give secrets, and they receive, but they don't necessarily give. It's a sort of one-way
trade.
So
a reserved character, happy in the company of his animals, obviously with a great reputation as a general behind him already.
Rommel is doing exactly the same. He's got a pair of miniature dachshunds. Yeah. So you see the same traits with commanders, which is absolutely fascinating.
It is, isn't it? Well, I suppose most people will know the bones of what Operation Overlord was, but what were they told that day? So there's going to be an assault on the beaches of Normandy, and were they given the exact locations and the code names for the beaches and which divisions were going to be sent against which beach?
Everything was laid out in full. So everybody there was security cleared. There were just over 140 gilt-edged invitations sent out. So it's a bit like a summons to something at Buckingham Palace, which is very apposite because His Majesty the King was there, sitting in the front row with Winston Churchill. It was a freezing cold day, so everyone was wearing greatcoats, and they're sitting on ordinary school benches, except Churchill and the King, who have armchairs. So that's austerity wartime Britain for you. Montgomery's at the front, and he leads, and then all his commanders follow, briefing their parts. And what they've done is they've laid out a huge map of the actual invasion coastline, and everybody, it's in an auditorium with tiered seating, and everybody is told exactly what's going to happen and when. And very importantly, Montgomery talks through the whole campaign and how he sees it unfolding over the 90 days, not just D-Day, but ever after. And the American general, Omar Bradley, in his memoirs, talks about Montgomery tramping around Lilliputian France, because all the details are there, representing the sort of the actual terrain.
Well, I liked something that you wrote, little details that stick in your mind. You were naming the beaches, of course. Most people will remember them. There's Omaha and Utah and Sword and Juno and Gold. Was it not Juno as jelly to begin with? And Churchill didn't like that, so he had that name amended. He didn't want to be
Yeah, so the three British stroke Canadian beaches are Gold, Sword and Jelly, and they're all kinds of fish.
Yeah.
Churchill, in 1943, had cottoned on to the fact that the Allies were coming up with some very weird code names, and he didn't want the difficulty of being able to say to a widow or the next of kin, your husband died on a beach called Jelly, in this case. So he had the code name changed.
And we got Omaha and Utah Beach, and you talk about that as well in the book, and how there's a bit of mystery over the naming of those, because it's never actually been shown where those names came from, but there are suggestions that maybe they were named after American GIs, is that right?
It's curious, being a historian, you sit on received wisdom all the time. So no one had sat down and really teased out where Omaha and Utah had come from. And if you did, the story was usually it was connected with the two American Corps commanders whose home states were allegedly Omaha and Utah. And Collins and Gerard don't come from either of those states, the American 7 and 5 Corps commanders. So that was wrong. So I dug a bit deeper. And the story I uncovered was that when Bradley had his headquarters in West London in Bryanston Square being renovated, the two GI carpenters who were reorganising his office where he could hang his maps. One came from Omaha and the other came from Utah. And there was a lot of banter between these two and General Bradley, and they would often queue up for coffee together and donuts. It's the GI way. Commanders, officers and men rub shoulders far more than in the British Army. And at one stage, Eisenhower joined in this little banter. And the question was, well, what are we going to name these beaches? And Bradley had said, well, Omaha and Utah, because that's where you two come from. Now, this is contained in someone's little notebook, contemporary with the period. It's very difficult to find other proof for that, but it's a nice little pebble to sort of throw in. And the point about Thunderclap was that there were really two options. Do we go to the Pas-de-Calais, as we've just discussed, or do we go to Normandy? And this was selling the conclusion that the Allies had come to, that the commanders had reached, that, you know, we have to rule out Calais because it's too obvious, it's too close, you could never cram all the men and machinery into the Pas-de-Calais area because the Germans would be able to see it so easily. And Normandy adds an element of mystery and surprise, and therefore we're choosing this for these reasons. So it's not just revealing what we're going to do, it's selling it as well to everyone who's there. And I mentioned that the King was in the front row. And of course we know a bit about King George VI from the King's speech. He's not a natural speaker. But at the end, he stood up and he addressed everyone and said, you know, this is a wonderful undertaking and I wish us well. And I can see how much hard work we've put into this and it will be successful. Now, his private secretary said afterwards, I never expected His Majesty to speak. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision, and there was none of the difficulty that he had felt making public speeches and announcements before. And it just shows you how much he's grown and matured as an individual and grown into his role.
Brilliant. Well, there's nowhere that we can go now apart from the obvious date, which is the 6th of June. So this is going to be your third scene. And this is a date that you remark right at the beginning of your book that there was no day in history quite like the 6th of June 1944. And I know you want to take us to a particular beach and with a particular character. So can you pick up the story of what's happening?
It is such a game changer of a day. We look back and it's perhaps the defining day of the Second World War, certainly in Europe. Even on the day, people would have realised how important it was. It's not one of those things where you suddenly look back and the analysts of history say that was the pivot, that was the tilting point. Everybody arriving off Normandy, taking part in it, sitting in a headquarters, monitoring what's going on, even the Germans, would have suddenly realised just how important that day was, even before they locked horns with their opponents.
Just geographically, which one?
Yeah, so that's the British beach on the extreme eastern edge of the invasion front.
Okay. So what's associate
that
beach?
Well, this is where William the Conqueror came from in 1066. Okay. There is so much.
So it's already got a historical significance to the British.
Yeah, and William the Conqueror's deputy was a guy called Roger de Montgomery, whose descendant is Bernard Montgomery, who's going back. So there is a sense of everything coming full circle.
It's a strange echo, isn't it?
And even the Americans and Canadians, Brits in origin, many of them, would have realised that this was bizarrely history coming full circle.
Yeah. What's it like as a beach, sword beach, geographically, and the terrain of it? Is it a great big sweeping one? Is it contained within a bay, or is it...
Off to the east, not too far away, you've got the big port of Le Havre. So the worry there was German artillery coming in from the east. So we had quite a lot of Royal Naval support just off the beach in a form of battleships, whose idea was to sort of pound the French coast and suppress the defensive fire coming from the battleships. But I mean, if I sketch it out, what we've got is a sandy beach inland where the beach huts would have been, and a casino very famously at Ouistreham. The Germans have demolished most of the seafront buildings and they've built quite a lot of concrete gun positions. Four of those are obstacles on the foreshore designed to prevent tanks from moving inland or to wreck landing craft as they approach the beaches. Plenty of barbed wire and mines. And you would have seen that tracking further west, we would have had the Canadians landing on Juno, about 5 miles away. Beyond them, Juno Beach, British 50th Division. A big gap either side of the artificial harbour at Arromanche. And then about 12 miles beyond that, you've got the Americans landing at Omaha, the biggest beach, 5 miles long. And then another large gap, and around the corner where the terrain then turns north with the Cherbourg Peninsula, you've got the beach of Utah. And those are the five beaches. We've had paratroopers who've gone in ahead of us on either flank. If you imagine the beaches as an inverted left hand, and the thumb is Utah Beach and the four fingers are the other invasion beaches. Your little finger is Sword Beach, and the British are landing there at 7:25 on the morning of Tuesday the 6th of June.
Wow, okay, and are we with a particular person?
Well, let's go back to the person I met when I was 14 in 1975 on Sword Beach, and this is Piper Bill Millen. Wonderful guy. Clearly, at the age of 21, this was the most defining moment of his life. And he had grown up in the Scottish Highlands and had become the personal piper to the dashing Commando Brigadier Lord Lovett, who was then in charge of the 1st Special Service Brigade, which comprised four British Commando battalions. And in the headquarters element, Lovett, who lived in a castle, liked to have his piper with him everywhere, to pipe him into dinner even, had Millen play him ashore. And he'd asked Millen much earlier on in the year, "I want you and I want you to play bagpipes and play me ashore." And Millen had said, "Well, sir, bagpipes are now banned by the War Office because they alert the enemy and they're considered rather old-fashioned." And Lovett was of the old school and he said, "Oh, but that's the English War Office, you know it doesn't apply to us." So he had his way, and there was Bill Millen. And as he told me, he marched down the ramps playing his pipes. And the first thing that happened, he said, "Well, I was wearing my kilt, and as is traditional, nothing underneath. So as I hit the extremely cold English Channel, the temperature played havoc with my anatomy, and it was a struggle to carry on playing the pipes." And then he said, "My kilt rose up and floated on the ocean for a while, and it spread around me like a tartan jellyfish," which is a great visual image.
Well, all of this is modifying my image of D-Day, because all the sounds you expect to hear on those beaches, the whistling of gunfire and the shouts of people coming ashore, the splashing, the bagpipes aren't probably what you'd expect to hear, but they were going on Sword Beach.
It's all about morale, and that's partly why the British Army and every army have taken instruments into battle. They're a weapon of war, and it raises morale. You suddenly realise you're not alone, because someone, even if you can't see him or her, there's someone there playing an instrument on your side, a tune you remember, and all of a sudden you're not alone. And in days gone by, of course, those tunes were instructions. Hence bugle calls, drum rolls, and all the rest of it. And that's why music is so important all the way through the military. And here's a very good example of it on the D-Day beaches. So you run ashore, you bury yourself in a sand dune so that the bullets aren't going to get you, and you hear the piper. Now, Bill Millen can't run and hide. He has to walk up and down the sand playing his pipes while the brigadier works out what's going on and issues his instructions. And that removes the ability of other men to run and hide, because if Bill Millen is standing around with his pipes, you can't be a coward and hide. So it coaxes men out of the sand dunes. If they see young Millen playing his pipes, then you can see how it raises morale.
Yeah, what
and
an
induces
extraordinary,
people to do their duty.
Yeah, what an extraordinary spin on a familiar story that is, though, because we do think, if you think about it logically, these have been used as weapons, musical instruments, right throughout history. We were talking about the Battle of Hattin, which is in the Crusades a few weeks ago, and the same thing was happening there. This is just a constant form of boosting morale, as you say. But what happened on Sword Beach? Were they met with very fierce opposition there, or was it quite an easy stroll ashore?
Well, the shorthand is, the worst punishment was meted out to the Americans at Omaha Beach. And therefore, the reception on the other beaches diminishes by comparison. And the fascinating thing is, if you drill down and you start to talk to the veterans of each and every beach, and I've spoken to many who fought on each beach, they all actually had a very rough ride. The assault wave on any of the beaches were equally likely to be shot, sniped, killed, drowned. A huge number of people drowned before they even got to the beach because the weather was so rough. The English Channel and drowning accounted for 15% of the casualties on D-Day itself before anyone was even shot. Once you get ashore, a lot of the injuries are caused by shell fire. So Sword Beach, for the assault battalions that arrive there, is in many ways just as bad as Omaha Beach. The difference is the Americans defend at Omaha longer, and therefore the casualties are higher, whereas the defenders at Sword Beach are overcome within the first couple of hours, and that's the difference.
So if we talk about, 7:25, they're going ashore, by late morning they've established a beachhead.
And that's the case along the other beaches as well, but because of terrain, high cliffs at Omaha, the Germans are hanging on for longer, and it'll take probably 4 or 5 hours for most of them to be overwhelmed, and that's the essential difference. And it's snipers who cause a lot of the damage. So if I go back to Bill Millin, he later meets a German prisoner who said to him, "I was a sniper and I had you in my sights." And Millin said, "Well, why didn't you shoot?" And the German said, "Because you're mad. You're mad standing in front of your men playing that instrument. Of course I wasn't going to shoot you. It would waste a bullet. You're bonkers." Which, you know, it's a lovely, lovely story.
I certainly had no conception or hadn't thought at all about musical instruments being used on the beaches. But if we like loop this back round together, so we go back to Operation Fabius, which happened almost exactly a month before. Is what happened on the 6th of June a consequence of that good planning?
I interviewed a platoon commander years ago about D-Day, and before I even started, he said, "Let's look at the training, because the success of D-Day was down to the training, getting it right beforehand." And what makes D-Day successful is you're flung ashore, you're cold, wet, you're probably suffering from seasickness. The moment you're under fire, your friends are going down, and you're very lonely because you're often hiding from the shells. And that's where your training has to kick in. And if your training hasn't been any good, you don't know what to do. So Fabius confirms all this training. I mean, some British soldiers had come back from Dunkirk and had not fought the Germans since 1940, and they had trained for D-Day for 4 years. So that's how long the training is for some people, but certainly a year for everybody. We lost more people training in the year before D-Day than we actually did soldiers killed on D-Day itself.
That's a really striking statistic, isn't it?
Getting the soldiers to France is only half the battle. Sustaining them while they're there is the other half. But also you have huge redundancy for the unexpected to happen. So the rough weather causes a delay for 24 hours. We can cope with that. We've got enough extra fuel. The German Luftwaffe occasionally appear or don't appear. We've got means of dealing with that. We can stop the German reinforcements coming up because we've briefed the French resistance about what to blow up. So there's a huge array of different plans. How do you get tanks ashore through the rough surf? Well, we create swimming tanks. What do we do about logistics if you haven't captured a port? We design our own and tow them across the channel.
The famous Mulberry Harbour.
The famous Mulberry Harbour. They are the tip of the iceberg, because we go into all sorts of special innovations. Innovation is the key, not just training. And we are so good at that in the Allied forces, and get better even during the unfolding campaign.
Well, it's an enormous story. We've only been able to scratch the surface, really. But what you've given us is some really strong human perspectives that go, you know, from the king making his speech at that meeting to the piper on the beach, which is an image which is actually going to linger with me, I think, quite strongly. And also, let's move out of your travels now and just talk a little bit about the book for a couple of minutes, because obviously we've been talking about preparation and logistics here. Your book is structured.
The structure of the book is the first half is really the training, and the more I wrote about the training, the more I researched it, and I drew on the interviews I've done. Of course, I've been in many ways researching D-Day ever since I walked those beaches first in 1975, so I've interviewed over the years over 1,000 people who were in some ways associated with Operation Overlord. And I wanted to draw as many of those in as possible. It's all the training, it's the 3 million Americans in England, the love affairs they have, the way they changed our society. They brought Spam with them, they brought nylon stockings, they brought the first freeze-dried coffee, Nescafe. You know, it's sort of part of our culture, and you know, they were criticised for being oversexed, overpaid and over here, and they would retort that we were underfed, undersexed and under Eisenhower. So there's all of that sort of wartime repartee.
Yeah.
But they made a huge impression. And I think just at the moment when Britain got it, was at its most austere and drab and unpleasant in the middle of wartime, the Americans arrive with colour, yeah, with their music, with Glenn Miller, with their rations, and all of a sudden they give the entire population a lift that they desperately need. And they come with their own rations, and nobody has seen peaches for 4 years and things like this. And so it's partly that effect. And it's the beginning, of course, of the special relationship. This is why American presidents have come over for the key anniversary moments ever since.
And we've got one on the way very, very shortly, I believe. It's 75 years ago. How should we look back at D-Day now, do you think?
You can't get away from the fact that it's become the shorthand for the Second World War. Dunkirk perhaps is really important for us. I was really struck by the way the sea actually dominates our story of World War II. For the British, it's leaving France in 1940 from Dunkirk. For the Canadians, it's coming across the Atlantic. For our survival, it's all the supplies and ships that come across and dodge U-boats in the Battle of the Atlantic. And then for D-Day, it's mounting this great assault across the English Channel and sustaining it. So it is very much a sort of story of the waves. But for us, I think World War II, if you want to encapsulate it in one day, it's the 6th of June 1944, and we look back on that as the beginning of Europe's freedom. And even the Germans do. I was very struck at the time of the 50th anniversary, which is when the Germans really began to participate, that they regarded the 6th of June as the beginning of their freedom as well from the Third Reich. And it was the beginning of the end of Nazi tyranny. It was the beginning of the end of liberation of the occupation of France. So in many ways, it is the end for Germany and the beginning of something else for the whole of Europe in different ways.
That's a wonderful way of explaining the greater resonances of the story. And at the end of these podcasts, I like to throw a bit of a curveball to you, because we've been metaphorically travelling around from our three scenes. And I always like to ask people, if you could bring one tangible object back from this time, from 1944 to today, you could have anything you like, what would you like to get?
Well, I've done my best to bring a lot of tangible objects back from various battlefields. You should see
you
my
can have another
office.
One.
I can have another one. One of the American paratroopers who was landing in the middle of the Cherbourg Peninsula gathered his men together, and in the small hours they heard a staff car rumbling towards them. And they shot at the staff car, it ground to a halt, and a German officer tumbled out, and they shot him, and his hat rolled away. And one of the officers picked up the hat, and inside was the word Falli, and that was the surname of the first German divisional commander, a general, to be killed in Normandy. Because he's killed, the Germans don't know how to react in that part of Normandy. And if someone were to magically bring me his hat...
Well, that's what I'm proposing. I have it metaphorically here. I'll pass it to you.
It's a metaphor for why we do so well, because D-Day comes as a surprise to the Germans. And at the end of the day, they don't know how to react. They are surprised, and it's the loss of so many of their senior commanders in the first few days that means the lower echelons are running around like headless chickens. And the killing of General Falli in the very first hours of D-Day underlines the fact that we wrong-foot the Germans. We cut off the head, and the rest don't know what to do.
Well, we have his hat. We have a wonderful conversation. Thank you very, very much today, Peter Caddick Adams, and all the very best with your book.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a huge pleasure and a real privilege to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Well, that was me, Peter Moore, travelling back to the events of 1944 with Dr. Peter Caddick Adams and talking about his book, Sand and Steel, just the other day. The book's out now. But what really is going to remain with me, I think, after our conversation is that picture of the piper on Sword Beach walking up and down in the early morning light and playing his bagpipes. And it seemed to me a strangely humane and powerful image. Many thanks to Ryan Bernstein for giving us a little blast of Dwight Eisenhower right at the start of this episode. He's got his own podcast called 50 States of Mind, which is all about modern US politics. You should go and check that one out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Travels Through Time. Please leave a comment or subscribe to our feed to get the first news of new episodes. The next one will be out in a fortnight's time. But from me and for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. And on our website, you'll find articles relating to Peter Caddick Adams' travels. Caroline Reed looks at the Allied propaganda campaigns that accompanied the D-Day landings. Geoffrey Warner examines the reasons for the long delay in opening a second Allied front. And Michael Paris heads to the cinema to explore how D-Day has been recreated on film. All of these can be found at historytoday.com/travels. And there are many more articles covering every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.
We'll accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.